super group. A group welcome in China or Russia or France or Italy, wherever they may be. Now, religion has one difficulty in this particular point. Religion has not yet been able to consolidate its own strength. Religion has not yet come to the realization of the unity of the concept of God. Religions still have interpretations that are in conflict. Now, conflict in interpretation is due largely to the absence of basic fact, or it can arise from language differences or from social and climatic differences. But regardless of the origin, the various parts of the religious community cannot cooperate effectively, at least they do not cooperate at the present time. Therefore, we have several major world religions, all dedicated to the same moral and social ends, all very largely worshiping the same concepts of divinity and its operations in creation, yet unable to meet upon any common ground. And why this inability to meet? It is the result of a long traditional theological structure in which each faith firmly believes that it was predestined and foreordained to rule the world. Now, this type of situation is the great weakness of religion. Religion has not yet been able to break through a peculiar physical belief that really should have long ago passed into the keeping of science. Namely, that it is perfectly possible to consider deity simply to be an expanded, unfolded, dramatized form of human being. The deities of the past were deified mortals, or at least had this general appearance. We have not yet come to the realization of the nature of the ultimate cause of things. Science doesn't know what it is, and theology doesn't know what it is. Theology has been locked in theological structures which have differed as to the nature of God sufficiently to create creeds, sects, and religious divisions. Science has not been any more successful. And here are the two groups. Science trying to get out of the dilemma by denying the existence of conflict, and religion trying to get out of the dilemma by continually warring in order that one can control the others. So we have a little problem here that comes down to our personal living in a great many cases. Here we are as individuals in a world of which our bodies are largely dominated by science and our hearts and minds largely inclined toward religion. And in the midst of this situation is this grave question at the moment, a question that has really very little significance, as to the nature of our own essential beings. What is man, says the scripture, that thou shalt be mindful of him? Well, what is man? What is humanity? Scientifically, he is merely a precocious biped without feathers. According to theology, he is the noblest production of deity. Actually, what is the human being and how should he view himself? If he doesn't respect his own nature, if he doesn't have any convictions that are worthwhile, how can he regulate and control and direct his own life? In looking around into the animal kingdom in which surrounds us, we observe that between the human being and the animal, there is an incredible, insurmountable obstacle. There is no way of assuming that the human being is simply a highly sophisticated animal. When we study the animal kingdom, we come into a realization that if the animal had the same potential faculties and powers that we have, he would have run humanity off the planet long ago. We are outnumbered by everything from bees to ants and major quadrupeds. We are a minority group in a vast system of life. We are yet in a unique position. One of the reasons for our misunderstandings, I think, has been our tendency to humanize the animal. In other words, we talk to cats and dogs. Probably they may understand some of it. Perhaps, however, it isn't the talk they understand. Perhaps they have a psychic integration that gets the message. Many of them are very faithful to humanity. And yet between man and the animal, there are certain differences which is impossible to cross. One of these differences is thought, the individual power of the mind. In order to be human, the individual has memory. He has also the power mentally of projecting a future, which gives him the privilege to improve, change, and modify his own existence. The human being is the only creature that we know in the visible world which is capable of self-directive, that is capable of dominating a situation, and most of all, of verbalizing it. Speech has separated man from the animal from the beginning. And while the animal is a very lovable and wonderful creature in many instances, it is not right, either to us or to the animal, for us to assume that we are directly bound to them by a biological factor. Let us assume then the fact as it is, that two orders of evolution are working at the same time in nature. One is physical evolution. Here Mr. Darwin had something on his mind and he really made an important contribution. In other words, nature is continually unfolding bodies. And these bodies move from one degree of efficiency to another. And the most efficient and complex and useful physical body ever created is that of the human being. In the human being, there are potentials which are latent in all lesser animal or plant, vegetable, mineral forms. Physical evolution is producing nobler mansions, but there is not anything to indicate here that this physical evolution does control that which is in the body. The ancients would have agreed, largely, that evolution of form is inevitable and proper, but that the evolution of life through form is a separate function. That which form makes possible, the house that form builds, has its proper occupant. And each order of life is a level of internal life development and unfoldment. Therefore, what we call the human being is not the body, but the life moving through that body. A life which has fashioned gradually the form we call human through long periods of evolution, and a life which adjusts the new body with each embodiment to the needs and characteristics and qualities of its own purposes. Therefore, the higher form of evolution is the evolution of life. The lower form is the evolution of bodies. These two work together. And each time an embodiment occurs, that which enters in belongs to the proper level of life. Only the human being can enter into the human form. Because of the unfoldment and evolvement of its superphysical structure, therefore, we think of it and refer to it very often theologically as man being a body and soul. And it is the soul in the body that makes it human. And it is the human soul that makes the human being possible. It is the animal soul that makes the animal possible. Both points of view have certain integrities, but to attempt to unite them and assume that the body and the dweller in the flesh, that these are identical, is against practically every system of rationalistic thinking the world has ever created. The human being is human and is born and bred by human parents and receives its gift of a human life spark. And this humanity is that which inhabits the body after the quickening and gradually molds it into the purposes of the incarnating entity. The body is definitely traceable back through all the forms of life that have been found before. And psychologically, we can trace the life principle back through the various levels of life. But unfortunately, we are unable to experience directly any level of life except our own. We cannot relive the life of a plant or an animal, because actually we are not part of those kingdoms. But we can, from an outward study of the forms of these creatures, understand something of the life in them, because this life is manifested in their functions and in their processes and in the circumstances which they impel into existence. Therefore, it would seem that religion and philosophy are especially related to the person in the body, the being that is in the flesh, whereas the body itself is a proper subject for physical scientific consideration. It can be helped. It can be more valuable in its needs. It can be served by the physical. Science can help to make the house better for the person dwelling in it. But no matter how much it improves the house, it cannot control, direct, or dominate the life of the occupant, because the occupant has an entirely different level of function. Actually, we also have a tendency in trying to understand these things of assuming that all forms of consciousness in nature are identical with our own. This is probably an erroneous conclusion. What we call consciousness is our own experience of the function of the life principle within us. For us, consciousness expresses itself through the ego, through the mind, through the emotions, through the vital resources of the body. And it is this dweller in the flesh that helps us to choose our careers, that helps us to decide and evaluate experiences, and this factor helps us to grow inwardly through the internalization of things that happen in our environment. In other words, the purpose of the body is to help the power in the body to become more and more sufficient to its own needs. If, for instance, the body gets into difficulties, as for instance in drug addiction, the being in the body must accept the challenge of this and either produce its own remedy. It must rise above this delinquency. It must learn to know the troubles that result from such addictions. And failing to note these things, it finally passes out of life, destroyed by its own weakness, selfishness, or misunderstanding. Now again, science says when it leaves, that's all there is to it. This again is contrary to every legitimate purpose of a natural phenomenon, that the individual, having passed through a whole variety of experiences, should then disappear forever, cease to exist, and have no future being of any kind. This seems to be a position that cannot be tolerated philosophically. This brings philosophy into focus as the power to bring together the scientific and the religious points of view. As philosophy becomes the reconciler of opposites, it becomes, in a sense, the mediator between all extremes in life. All philosophy worthy of the name, and it's not too abundant at the present time, all philosophy deals with the problem of adequate purpose. Things that happen, happen for a reason. There is no waste motion in life. There are no occurrences that are meaningless. Everything has significance of some kind. Everything that happens in the outer life affects the inner person within that body. Every attitude, every contact with society modifies the pattern of the person in the body. When the time comes for the person and the body to separate, the person survives. And more, even the scientific communion is beginning to assume the possibility of life after death. Life after death was accepted by our most primitive ancestors. It has always been known intuitively as part of our eternal realities. But up to recently, it has been considered unscientific, perhaps because, as one prominent educator said of it, that it was that philosophy and idealism was a sickly mysticism that interfered with the glory of facts. Well, the glory of facts look rather shabby at the moment. The glory is not noticeable. But the fact of the matter is that unless we are here for a purpose, the entire existence of living things has no meaning whatsoever. And having no meaning, there is no hope. For if there is no meaning, no reason, no methodology by which anything can be accomplished, then we live and die in a state of complete bewilderment and have been exploited from the cradle to the grave. Such is not the case, fortunately, for all concerned. And it is obvious that the experiences of a lifetime are not kept in record in the body alone. The body does not know anything about how we felt about our neighbors, except that when we feel wrongly about our neighbors, the body knows something is wrong. But it does not gain moral instruction from the happenings of the person in the body. But the vibration of the person in the body, if it becomes better and higher, does elevate gradually the bodily elements and puts the bodily cells into an inhabitable universe of their own. It prevents the destruction of the multitude forms of life within our own flesh. If we then assume, as is almost necessary, that there is something beyond the present, then in a large measure the whole structure of science falls apart. Because if there is something more in life or to life, then the immediate frenzied accumulation of wealth or power, then we have been living falsely from the beginning, and science has been trying to build up something that cannot survive. It is therefore very important for us to try to ensoul the world in which we live. And I think that really, of the animals and other kingdoms of nature, man becomes symbolically a conscious ensoulment of life as this ensoulment develops on this level of existence. In other words, man represents, more or less, a soul power in the material world, the power of inner consciousness, inner dedication, inner understanding and realization to transmute and transform the outer environment into an appropriate and proper place for the development of life. The human being has tremendous potentials. These potentials include a number of faculties, not only of communication, but of memory, of ideation, of internal mysticism. It makes possible the rise of esoteric disciplines, sciences, and philosophies. It definitely indicates that gradually the human being is able to take over his own destiny. This is something that sets him entirely apart from every other kingdom of nature. There is no other kingdom that we know that can create a future destiny for itself by intent, that can take the rough materials of life and then soul them with purposes beyond survival. The other kingdoms are largely tied into a survival pattern, which is always present, is always dominant, and requires practically the entire life of the living creature. The animal kingdoms live in one or two principles alone. They have to feed, they must have nutrition, and they have to generate and reproduce. Food and reproductive power constitute the burden which all kingdoms below man must carry. Now, this doesn't mean that man doesn't have to carry them also, but it means that man is capable of a complete life above them. The human being is not required to spend all of his life feeding himself and that alone, nor is he required to exist only to the point of generation or perpetuation of species and then an immediate departure. The human being has other overtones which must be developed or can be developed by the proper aptitudes and the proper dedications. The human being has a life fulfillment within itself. It has a duty to itself, which is another form of nutrition. Man's material nature perpetuates the species. Man's soul perpetuates and unfolds itself by a psychic nutrition, the nutrition of ideals, of dreams, of hopes, of aspirations, and of dedications. As the old story of the Greek banquet tells us, there is food for the body, but there is also the banquet of the soul, a kind of holy communion in which the individual nourishes the inner life by the merits of its own conduct, by its dreams, its aspirations, and its dedications. So that this means definitely that the human being was created or fashioned or evolved, or whatever you want to call it, for a purpose that is unique in nature. It is because of this uniqueness in nature that the human being controls or is capable of controlling every other form of life. It cannot create another form of life, but it can direct it, unfold its resources, it can curb it or expand it, it can give it greater opportunity or destroy its privileges. The human being, in a strange way, is the leader of this herd of souls that we find embodied in the kingdoms of nature. Therefore, man is a unique creature. It is not possible to assume that we can explain man merely as an animal with one step further ahead. It is not only this, it is a completely different organization, not physically, but because it contains within it a being more highly devolved and developed than any other creature that has created a visible likeness among us. Man has the tremendous advantage of being capable of creating not only materially but spiritually. not only generating forms, but generating ideas capable of reproduction in an internal spiritual sense of that term. Because of this, the individual also has appropriate responsibilities. He is faced with the duties of his own identity. If his duties were simply to feed and rent, generate, we'd have very little problem, because animals don't have too much problems of this nature. They have their territories, and they abide by them, and they follow laws and instincts which are immutable. Man is not a servant of instincts that he is unable to direct or control. The human being is a self-moving mechanism. It is a being capable of unfolding higher levels than any other kingdom that we know. But in order to do this, the individual must have some motivation. And our school children need motivation. Young people today and older folks too need some form of motivation which will enable them to live above and beyond physical pressures. To lock the soul within the body after it has been given dominion over it is a sad mistake. And yet in most people, the soul is merely an energy which is a servant of desires, ambitions, and personal feelings. The soul is not being permitted to perform its essential duty of directing the life within the person and protecting the body in which that life is enclosed. So man has to improve from within out. He has to lead from the soul and not from the body. He has to use the mind and emotions to advance the universal good and not merely to further little small selfish projects of his own. Yet if we are so educated that little things are all that we ever learn of, if it is assumed that importance simply consists in doing what we please, then we have missed the entire purpose of our existence. Nature, however, is not going to be frustrated so easily. If the individual or a generation or a race or a species fails completely in its purposes, nature simply eliminates it. We have lost the dinosaurs, we have lost the Megatheriums and the Brontosauruses because they were no longer useful, because they contributed nothing to the plans and purposes of life. We are watching species and types fading away today because they have no further need for the experience of this environment. Man, however, has not achieved a diploma of graduation. He is not as yet using his potentials and his purposes correctly. And young people should be told this. They should not be so much concerned as to where they came from in terms of the Darwinian theory, but where they're going in terms of cosmic purpose. This is the emphasis. Every young person should be taught the dignity of his own contribution to life. He should be taught that there is within him something that he can use to better others and serve himself in this way. That he is not here simply to get rich or powerful. He is not going to be a success because he is a computer operator. He is here to grow, not only in skills, but in grace. And his skills should be under the domination of his integrities. The more proficient he becomes in some line of activity, the greater the contribution he can make to enduring good, not merely to some passing project that seems to have economic possibilities. We have great need to give young people reason for life. And today this idea of trying to create an arbitration between the theory of generation and the theory of creation and let the children decide which to follow is not very practical, for the reason that the average child can't decide. They have not the experience, they have not the background. It seems to me that the arbitration lies on an entirely different level, namely that the purpose of science is to invent and discover. The purpose of religion is to learn to use wisely and unselfishly all the skills of mankind. Therefore, religion is involved in the use of that which science may claim to discover. Religion makes things valuable to the survival of life on this planet. Knowledge is increasing very rapidly, but unless integrity grows with it, we cannot depend upon a livable future. So maybe it would be just as well to not try to force which one is correct, but to point out that each of these courses of action, creation and generation, each has a practical, visual, moral term which it can fulfill. Therefore, that instead of trying to decide which is the best of them, let us form a partnership between the two concepts. Let science keep on exploring, and let religion or philosophy apply what is found to the common good. But if science insists that any constructive use of its discoveries is an interference with the right of discovery, then we are in trouble again. It should be that whatever science finds, it should allow human experience to apply for the common good. It is useless to assume that integrity is an interference with progress. It is not. It is the integrity that makes change progress. And without integrity, change is nothing. We can add all we want to the so-called skills of mankind. But if these skills are not ennobled by purpose, all is in vain. And there is no reason why the scientist who likes to explore and discover should not even more greatly rejoice when he realizes that what he is discovering is going to be used for the good of mankind. And if that enjoyment and that power does not arise in his own thinking, then he is not a safe citizen of the world. If he does not want what he invents to be used well, he should not be permitted to carry on these projects. And if it becomes necessary, because of his own misuse of knowledge, to put some censorship upon these matters, then it is for his good as well as for the good of others. For the scientist who goes on with his nuclear research may live to see it destroy his own children. This type of situation is not good. Materialism has always been faced with it, and religion has always come forward to meet this emergency. And the greatly increasing interest in religion that we have at the present time is the result of the fact that progress as we know it is becoming too dangerous, and that unless it is curbed in some way, unless some form of inner reality comes into existence, we are all in trouble. And both religion and philosophy suspect profoundly that this tremendous energy, which we call life, this power that makes all things possible, is not a blind force. That it is also a conscious moral energy, and that all energy has in its very substance and essence a soul factor. It is an ensouled energy which creates. It is an ensouled energy which generates. And if energy is used by created creatures or generated beings against the use of its own proper values, energy itself can revolt, and energy itself can remove itself from that which abuses it, or falsely uses it, or corrupts it, or perverts it. So that little by little, the tremendous censorship of the infinite comes upon us. And in order to meet that censorship with integrity, I think we have to realize that man is a living soul, that his body is of the earth, to which it will return. but his soul belongs to an higher order of life, which is moving triumphantly toward the perfection and service of the divine plan. We live in these two levels. We must balance them within ourselves. And if one is to gain advantage over the other, it must be the power of the soul to win the body, to take the body and make it an instrument of the purpose of that divine part of man, which is his hope of glory. If we can begin to think these things through, we will not be impractical, but we will realize that a practical philosophy of life must justify life, must make it meaningful and worthwhile, must make also a progress, which we can all share and all labor together for the common good. If we take these points into consideration, we probably can make a comparative link between science and religion. That we will render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and that includes body, wealth, physical environment, but also at the same time can render unto God the things that are his. And if we want to assume that the material world belongs to the deities of the underlife, at the same time that there is a superior world, and man is a creature, has been endowed with the power to know this. And of all the creatures that we know, man alone has the hope of a greater destiny. He is the one being who is able to change all things for the good. And if he does not use this energy, there is stagnation. If he perverts it, there is disintegration. It is a part of our plan to realize that man is not an animal. Man is a being dedicated to the service of that which his inner life has revealed to him. And if he makes proper use of this inner life, his outer life will be orderly, proper, and constructive. If we control the negative factors of our own dispositions, we can live in a world in peace with each other and in harmony with the divine purpose. Well, I guess that's it, folks.